So who is Australia and who might we become? The question suggests to us the importance of narrative. The question has in it a narrative. What is our narrative? And narrative is so important both to our sense of identity, of course, and our history and the intertwining of those two things. But when I think of who is Australia right now and who might we become, I do wonder about that with some dread, I have to say. Sometimes we think waking up every day things get worse. One dreads to think who we might become, and indeed are in the process of becoming right now. I was interested in speaking tonight because I think this question provides a departure point for considerations between the past and present, the forces that shaped us, and the challenges that confront us. An Anzac Day week provides an appropriate time frame as the media collaborates with government agencies as never before to suggest that Australian values are militarist values. Think about it. That's what this all suggests, that Australian values are militarist values, that our nation was founded at Gallipoli, that the destructive imperial European war that killed millions of people was, strangely enough for Australia, the supreme creative event of our history, that this gave birth to the nation and our national values, that this catastrophe worldwide somehow turned creative for us. The domination of the media by both Anzac Day and concurrently the royal visit during the last couple of weeks kept bringing to my mind, sort of unbidden, the word meretricious. And so insistent was meretricious in my mind, I had to sort of look it up. I loved looking up words in the dictionary. So I jumped up to look at exactly what it meant, and I thought, ah, it means showily but falsely attractive. Isn't that wonderful? A wonderful word. Showily but falsely attractive. You know, it's such an appropriate word. It might sound harsh, perhaps, but I think it well describes media representations of both Anzac Day and the Royal Tour and much in between. Combined with the constant discussion of why there have to be massive cuts to our health, welfare, education, old age pensions, childcare budgets, at the same time as the Prime Minister boasts that, quote, Australia is open for business and poses for photographs in a fighter jet, it's enough to make one feel very sad for our country, I think, poor fellow, my country. I feel deeply sad when I realise with what promise the Commonwealth of Australia began, the idealism that informed that name, the choice of the name Commonwealth, and the project of collective obligation and provision and commitment to the vulnerable, to infants and mothers, the elderly and invalids, workers in homes and in factories that defined the idea of citizenship around 1901. I'm currently engaged on a large research project on the international history of Australian democracy. And the book I'm trying to finish writing this year is called Our Common Ideals. The idea was to research both the impact of Australian democratic innovation on developments internationally, but also to track the impact of new understandings of human rights encoded by the 20th century organisations, the League of Nations, the ILO, and the UN, the impact of those new understandings of human rights back home, as it were, on Australia. So it's a sort of reciprocal process. It's a very large project, obviously, and I can only deal with some aspects of it at a time. I've looked, for example, at the ways in which Chinese colonists' demands for recognition of their common human rights, a phrase they used in the 1880s, probably one of the first times that that phrase was used in Australian political history. They wrote reams of sort of booklets and petitions demanding recognition of what they called their common human rights, and that this fed into international campaigns against racial discrimination that went to the Universal Races Congress in London in 1911, and then went to Versailles in 1919, and then to Dumbarton Oaks in 1944. Which, of course, was the foundation of the Charter and the Universal Declaration at the UN. And that campaign by Chinese-Australian colonists in the 1880s was quite an important stream in that international burgeoning. So that's one of the unexpected ways, when you think of Australia's international democracy, that's one of the examples. Right now, though, I'm focusing on the period of nation-building from the late 1870s, of which that was part, until the outbreak of World War I. When Australian intellectuals, political leaders, and civil activists were engaged in defining what they thought of as a new civilization dedicated to the goal of social justice for its citizens, especially women and workers. One can often see these developments most clearly from outside the country, from beyond the nation. That's another sort of aspect of looking at doing this international history, is that you can often find out as much about Australian democracy in the New York Public Library as you can researching it here at home. Because distance lends a certain perspective, I think. It enables you to see things more clearly sometimes. For example, something I wrote about in The Age the other day, the significance of the first legal minimum wage, which was an Australian invention. The first legal minimum wage was passed in Victoria, the colony of Victoria in 1896. And I hadn't quite grasped the significance of this in worldwide terms until I did read about it in the New York Public Library, when many, many significant American reformers and intellectuals, including people like Walter Lippmann and Florence Kelly, saw how significant this was. At the end of the 19th century, sort of marking really the end of a period of slavery, that is, labour conceptualised as commodity, etc. What American political commentators who were most interested in these social experiments noticed was that in the first decade of the Commonwealth of Australia, the figures they called the voting woman and the working man advanced hand in hand, as it were, bringing about a number of path-breaking reforms and the election of the first Labor government in the world. One of its reforms was the maternity allowance in 1912 that extended to unmarried mothers, which was then unheard of, a reform introduced by Labor Prime Minister Andrew Fisher in response to pressure from Labor women activists that recognised the rights of citizen mothers, as Fisher put it, to modest economic support in their time of trial. It's interesting, by the way, to the extent people know about this in history, they often refer to it as a baby bonus and that it was a sort of pro-breeding measure. But in fact, the women who lobbied for it, the Labour women, and Fisher himself were adamant that this was a payment, as Fisher said, for mothers in their capacities as citizens. Conservative critics of the maternity allowance complained that it was a mere vote-catching measure. And in fact, this is interesting. It was really popular, of course, with women. And so therefore conservatives who opposed it said it was a mere vote-catching measure, cynically designed to win the newly enfranchised women voters to support the Labour Party. American commentators, on the other hand, were impressed by women's empowerment in Australia. In 1902, Australia had become the most democratic country in the world, with the extension of full political rights to women, the first country in the world in which that had happened, although New Zealand women had won the vote, but not the right to stand for Parliament. And, you know, you wonder, why isn't this celebrated as a national value, as a founding value? This is 1902, it's a world historic achievement. And yet, you know, look what happens to Julia Gillard, 100 years after that. So many women I know voted informal in the election in response to the misogynist attacks on our first woman prime minister. So we don't simply go forward. In 1902, the New York Times reported the American veteran suffragist Carrie Chapman Catt, her observation of the world historic significance of Australian women's enfranchisement. This is 1902 in the New York Times. Carrie Chapman Catt said, while the principles of democracy were first enunciated in the United States, Australia has carried them furthest and nearest to their logical conclusion. One Chicago newspaper noted at the same time in a headline, "She votes in Australia." I think that's a wonderful, wonderful headline, sort of like full of, you know, foreboding perhaps. "She votes in Australia." American feminist temperance supporter and champion of Cuban independence, Josephine Henry, similarly rhapsodised over the extension of political rights to women, as she put it in her column, "For the first time in the history of the world." This, she said, was an object lesson that would, quote, help the cause of human liberty throughout the earth. And she made a point of noting that this new nation had come into being in peacetime, a point I think John Hirst made the other day in the paper, not through processes of war. I mean, this is the other irony. there are many ironies associated with Anzac mythology, but this is one of them. The new nation comes into birth during peacetime. Visitors came to Australia in this decade before the outbreak of World War I from all over the world to see these experiments for themselves. I mean, imagine making that trip. I mean, it was a trip across the sea that took months and months, and they came from the United States, from Britain, from Germany, from Switzerland, from China, because China, you know, is going through its modernising process and about to have a revolution, and Chinese Democrats came to look at the Australian experiments. They came to see this experiment station, as one of them called it, for themselves. Imagine anyone doing that now. I mean, this is the other thing I was thinking about. What would they come to see? You know, people coming to see dramatic new reforms. When the Boston feminist called Maud Park Wood toured Australia in 1909, for example, she was impressed by the impact of women's newfound political power. When entertained at tea parties hosted by members of the Senate and the House of Reps, it was clear that political leaders on all sides of politics, she said, were anxious, quote, to secure this large body of new and as yet uncommitted voters. Park was impressed in particular by what she called women's equal standing in the industrial and political organisation of the Labour Party, and, quote, the sense of the political equality of women in a country where they are enfranchised was a deep-rooted conviction. And it's really interesting to look at these visitors when they come to Australia and look at these things and their impressions that they write up. That was 1909. And as I said before, what happened in the intervening decades that allowed sexism to flourish so unashamedly 100 years later? Another international visitor was Professor M.B. Hammond from Ohio State University, who was interested in state action to secure decent wages and working conditions as a precondition for industrial harmony. Australians were also at the forefront of world history in regard to wages and conditions, as Hammond told readers of the American Economic Review in 1913 after his return. He said they had placed on the statute books, quote, a body of social legislation which, quote, has drawn the eyes of all the world to the new Commonwealth and which, quote, marked the most notable experiment yet made in social democracy. The most notable experiment yet made in social democracy. People often talk about Germany or wherever, but this, says this expert, this is what happens in Australia. Hammond had visited Australia in 1911 when he took a year's sabbatical leave from his university, as he told John Andrews in the American Association for Labour Legislation. And again, that's really interesting, isn't it? He gets a year's sabbatical leave, and where does he choose to take it? He chooses to come to Australia to look at the social and political experiments here. He explained to the American Association for Labour Legislation, he said, I've taken a year's leave of absence from the university and I'm planning to spend most of it in New Zealand and Australia in studying the experimental legislation of those lands rather than go to the old world countries. English experience with the minimum wage, he says, has been too brief and too limited in its industrial range to afford much information for constructive purposes or to enable us to judge as to the general acceptability of the principle. Throughout Australasia, on the other hand, he said, the principle of the minimum wage has now found general acceptance. And it's interesting, I wrote the article in The Age the other day in response to the fact that, you know, lo and behold, even the minimum wage is now being discussed as something that the Conservatives think they might abolish. I mean, it's such an Australian institution, which I pointed out. But then someone responded to me on email and said, we've got to get rid of those old ways of thinking. Which, you know, is so selective, isn't it? You know, in some places we get rid of it. Hammond's subsequent articles did much to publicise Australian innovations in minimum wages, wages boards and arbitration. So by the time the president of the Commonwealth Conciliation Arbitration Court, the noble H.B. Higgins, arrived on his trip to the United States in June 1914, 2 months before the outbreak of war, and little did the poor man know what was going to happen, including the death of his only son. By the time Higgins arrived in the United States, he was besieged by people all around, by journalists and by judges and by academics, by labour reformers, by feminists who all wanted to talk to him about what was happening in Australia. And they all commissioned articles from him, and one of the most famous he wrote was commissioned by the Harvard Law Review, called A New Province for Law and Order. Higgins was famous for theorising the living wage as a human right. And this was, again, one of the innovative things he did. He said a living wage is a new kind of human right, and it was a citizen's right. And so one of the judges, Learned Hand, it's such a wonderful name, isn't it, an American judge called Learned Hand, he wrote about Higgins' article in the new progressive journal, The New Republic, and explained that this was a sort of great leap forward in understanding citizenship. And so I then also look at Alice Henry, the Australian feminist labour reformer who went to the United States and worked for the National Women's Trade Union League in Chicago for about 26 years as the editor of its journal called Life and Labour. And she wrote a lot of stuff about the significance of the living wage. She, in one of her editorials in Life and Labour, she wrote this. She said, "It means more than humanity has ever asked for before. It is a noble, a dignified demand, something at least worthy of humanity. For it means more than life," she said. "It means the right at last for all to be human." And so I've sort of run out of time, but there is so much of this stuff where you get so many Australian activists, political leaders, intellectuals, radicals, progressives, who are filled with idealism and actually, of course, have a sense that they can create a new world, that they are creating a new world. Now, and of course, you know, and you think, what are Australian ideals today? If you were to ask someone or a political leader, what are Australian ideals? You know, what on earth could they say? Like Australia's open for business. Is that an ideal? So one of my sort of worries really is that around that time, the discourse on citizenship and ideals was extremely common. People used those terms all the time. Higgins, for example, wrote an essay called Australian Ideals in 1902. In World War One, actually, one of the socialists said that Hughes was behaving so badly that he was destroying Australian ideals. And so you get this sense that there were such things as Australian ideals. Now, I have to finish, but of course I haven't touched on even, I mean, with what's happening in Australia, there's so many bad things happening, but I haven't touched on the subject of asylum seekers. But our fear of those of a different race who appear from the north in boats, such as one of the first, the ship the Afghan, interestingly named, in 1888, also has a long history. And indeed, it's arguable that the imperative of border protection, the definition of national sovereignty as preeminently a matter of border protection, was constitutive of our sense of early nationhood. And so, of course, there's this paradox to our nationhood about this enclosed society that yet conjures up this enormously idealistic future. So I just wanted to finish with some examples, though, of in that very time, including the 1896 minimum wage, which was aimed to bring Chinese workers into the frame. Well, so I sort of wanted to finish up by saying that this enormously idealistic new Commonwealth of Australia, and the term Commonwealth was meant, you know, the idea was that citizenship was about a sort of obligation, it was about mutual sharing, it was about concern, but that this was set up behind borders erected by the White Australia policy. But I wanted to point out that there are several things that are more complicated than people think about the White Australia policy. One is that you already in Labor legislation started to get intimations that you would include in Australia, everybody would be included in this new Labor legislation. Now, particularly the minimum wage in 1896. One of the things about the minimum wage that is striking, or two things actually, or three things. First of all, it's compulsory, it's legal. That's what the Americans noticed. Secondly, it actually extended to adult men. That was extremely unusual for the time, because in Britain and the United States, hours and wages legislation only extended to women and children, you know, because they were vulnerable. In Australia, it extended to adult men. Now, it extended to adult men knowingly because it was also intended to cover Chinese workers in the furniture industry. But rather than exclude them from that regime, it was intended to make payment of a minimum wage compulsory. So it's an inclusive device that turns all of those, that forces employers, whoever they are, to pay this high wage and adhere to standards. Now, another example I came across, which again would be surprising to most people, is about Higgins and Aboriginal workers. Because people, as I say, assume, I think there's a quite simple-minded understanding of what Australia policy, but anyway, Higgins is extremely interested. As I said, he's the one who theorises the minimum wage as a living wage. And what he said was that the living wage should be sufficient to pay workers as human beings, hence that emphasis on human beings. That's what Alice Henry said. This is revolutionary, to treat workers not as commodities, not as slaves, not as contract labour, but as human beings. Now, when Higgins did that, he meant it to apply to all workers as human beings, although that was also qualified, which is another complicated story, by gender. But he came across a case in 1917 to do with Aboriginal workers. And a woman called Jude Elton in South Australia has done a really interesting PhD thesis on Higgins and Aboriginal labour. And so Higgins decided that in the Pastoral Industry Award he handed down in 1917 in wartime, that no male workers, whether black or white, would be allowed to work for less than the adult male award. That is, no workers would be dealt with as slaves. Now, when asked by the Australian Workers Union whether skilled Aboriginal workers could be paid the same wage as white workers, Higgins replied, "There will be no need of this black labour to be paid the same as white labour. I did not put in my award black, white or anything. If he is a member of your organisation and an employee, it is quite enough." But then the employers came back to Higgins at this court case and said they shouldn't have to pay Aboriginal workers a living wage because they already dealt with them in kind. They received remuneration in kind, you know, sort of rations or whatever. And Higgins says very sharply to them, he said, "It is argued that this is a patriarchal industry, unfit for the hard lines of rights." Isn't that a great phrase? He's saying to the employers, "You're saying that this is a patriarchal industry, unfit for the hard lines of rights." He says, "But I've yet to learn that in patriarchal times, those who did labour were reduced to the condition of these men without any right in respect of land or stock." And then he went on to say, "The truth is that these employees on stations have the normal needs of a human being as much as employees in the city." So these labour reforms, as I say, have in them the beginnings of a sense of inclusiveness that we in our time come to call multiculturalism. It was a remarkable and little known judgment, but that was in the southern states, of course, not in the north, where a whole different regime prevailed. Now, Australia then, finally, just to finish up, Australia has a complex past, differentiated by region as well as class. And Tim Rowse, the Australian historian, has written that when Australia federated, there were two Australias. There was the North and the South, and that's also an interesting story. Here I'm concentrating on Victoria, actually, as in the vanguard of democratic advancement, of social reform, of social democracy, of women's rights. There is ample evidence in our past, of course, of exploitation and oppression. You don't need to look far to find that. But there's evidence, too, of a strong sense of idealism and understandings of citizenship as entailing mutual care and obligation and a commitment to equal opportunity, and that term was used around 1901, ideals that we would do well, I think, to reinvigorate in our own time if we are to reach for a self-respecting future. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Marilyn, for introducing the topic in such a stimulating way. You've told us a lot about the ideals on which Australia was based. And I think there's the underlying suggestion that a lot of these basic values that perhaps we've taken a little for granted are now under challenge, and we may have to fight for them all over again. But there will be opportunity to draw Marilyn out further and to take her on if you want to do so later on. But meanwhile, thank you very much indeed, and I'm going to invite Nivi to speak to us now.
Hi everyone. So it's an honour to be here and an honour to follow you, Marilyn. That was amazing. I was kind of hoping you wouldn't stop. I'd just like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land upon which we stand today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my sincerest respects to their elders past and present. Firstly, I feel pretty strange being up here and talking about this topic, but it's a wonderful opportunity, so thank you to Pax, Christy, and everyone involved for asking me to come along and share just a couple of words. I don't think I'll speak for too long. So I was born in Australia and I was raised pretty much around the world. So you'll hear a different accent slipping in and out, but it's also one of the reasons why I am personally feel very invested in this idea of who is Australia and who or what this country may become, because I feel very much that my own personal story is always looking for a space or somehow to be recognised in our national rhetoric, which I feel, anecdotally, and speaking to a lot of young people I work with from culturally diverse backgrounds, it's becoming increasingly rare. The opportunity to be identified and included in the story and or in the way in which we tell the story of Australia and being Australian. To borrow a little from Marilyn, the story of Anzac Day is an incredibly important story in terms of the nation building of Australia. It's had some devastating consequences on what happened to our country and, you know, in many ways shapes who we've become today. I find it quite disconcerting of how the story of Anzac Day has been hijacked and co-opted to tell a very different story. I am, full disclaimer, an Essendon supporter, an Essendon member, have been for the past 10 years, and I go to Anzac Day at the MCG every year and have done for a long time. And the feeling, the sentiment I'm always struck with is a tremendous feeling of sadness when you think about the story of Anzac Day and how Australia got involved and the consequences of our great country being involved in fighting other people's wars, essentially. And it always reminds me, my brother always likes to tell me he fancies himself a budding historian. And he'll say to me, you know, Indians were involved in Anzac Day too. So we had about 5,000 Indian soldiers who were involved in various capacities. And Indians don't talk about Anzac Day. It's not a moment of great pride. It's actually another story of sadness. Colonized by a country, forced to fight their wars. What on earth was it all for? If it's even mentioned at all. And I just remember thinking about that a couple of years going, we're not in such extraordinarily different circumstances.
Exactly.
But the way we treat the story says something about what our political leaders look to achieve. And it's not an everyday Australian thing where we're hijacking the story of Anzac Day. I feel like we're being led down the garden path a little bit, and it makes me really uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable, as Marilyn said, where we're seeing funding cuts everywhere. We're seeing, you know, tens of millions of dollars being funded into Veterans Affairs, previously neglected or barely negligible. I worked for the public service, for the Victorian Public Service, for 2 years as a graduate, and I can just speak at the state level. So the Department of Veterans Affairs the Office of Veterans Affairs sat within the Department of Planning and Community Development, and I worked in the Community Development Division of DPCD, and we've liaised in terms of volunteer programs with the Office of Veterans Affairs before the budget came out for 2013, 2014, in which suddenly the only part of DPCD or the community development that had been funded was the Office for Veterans Affairs. And very soon after that, there was a change in our leadership, Victorian state leadership. Departments were shifted around in what's known as the Ministry of Government changes. Veterans Affairs got moved over to the Department of Premier and Cabinet. And I was like, oh, interesting. So quite clearly the flashlights go off and you realise there's a political imperative here that is tied to our centenary, and it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. And I think this coalition is amazing because you will be looking to diversify the story of Anzac Day and maybe shed some light on its political hijacking. The other thing, leaving that aside for a second, I find slightly separate. You know, how we tell the story of Australia is in many ways shaped by Anzac Day. It's a story I will never really be a part of. Even though I was born here, I didn't have family, obviously, who was involved in anything there. And when we talk about the story of Anzac Day, for me, it also reminds me when John Howard said things like our true Australian values. He's trying to tell us who we are, not just who we are, but what we look like also, and what new people coming to this country have to adopt too, in order to be like Australian in that almost American hand on your heart, you know, crying while you sing the national anthem kind of way. And I find it really interesting. And when I was asked to speak here, I was thinking very much about how the story of Australia is told and how we tell the story and how we relate to multiculturalism in many ways is very European. So if you look at many of the nations of Europe were formed obviously after the Treaty of Westphalia, and in the 1800s, forged in a way that nation states were formed around lines, sharing a common culture, sharing a common history, sharing a common language. And territorial integrity for European countries makes a lot of sense, right? Tying your identity to your shared history and culture, it does make a lot of sense. So when these countries were faced with migration, as we've seen over the past few decades, you know, as Germany reconciles with what it means to be German in the influx of Turkish immigrants, is not necessarily the same with how Australia deals, obviously, with immigration. The story of Australia and how we deal with immigration as a country that's pretty much founded on it is very similar, much more akin to the story of the United States. The melting pot, America, in other words. But we don't talk about, ironically, as much as our government loves the United States and will follow it into battle where in any opportunity it has, we don't seem to follow their rhetoric when it comes to this idea of how do many cultures become one and how do we move forward. The political commentator Waleed Ali has written about this a lot. There's an article he's written in The Monthly, which I would really recommend checking out. It talks about American values and juxtaposes this idea of America is a country of great contradictions. It's not obviously not a country without racial tension and discrimination and obviously a distressing history of Native American cultural decimation, slavery, many other different things. But somehow the American dream still exists, the American dream still perseveres. And one of the ideas that Waleed Ali puts forward is that the American dream is based not on a shared past, it's based on this common vision moving forward as a country upholding and embodying certain civic values, you know, political like freedom, equality, many of their slightly crazier values that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights, like the right to bear arms. So they have a very, very strong understanding of the political values that America was founded on very core concrete values that no matter what happens, no matter who comes, you take on these values and you become a part of the American story. And in this way, the United States has dealt with massive cultural divides and differences and influx of people from all over the world, but is still able to tell a common story. And I feel like as Australians, that might be a way that we can tell our story without excluding or without whitewashing our history. And the idea of Australia being, and as a nation, being birthed by Anzac Day, while no doubt Anzac Day has played a pivotal or maybe even vital role in shaping our nation's history, we tend the story of Australia without recognising our Indigenous culture in any way, shape or form that is even remotely in comparison with how we glorify the story of Anzac Day. And it makes me sad. It makes me really sad. So we whitewash our story and then we ask all the people who come to us, our country, on the 26th of January to pledge allegiance to Australia. And we keep on perpetuating this idea that Australia has a very clear beginning, slightly in many ways embodied by Anzac Day, but we don't talk about our Indigenous history. We glorify a particular aspect of our history, which is not without its problems. And we tell that story to exclude or make people feel like this is the story you have to adhere to, or you're not necessarily Australian. You're not Australian in the way our government would like you to think they are. And I find all of this quite strange. The political rhetoric does not match with Australia's governmental support of multiculturalism. So as a government, there's very few other governments in the world, both federally and at the state level, who have funded and supported multiculturalism in such a bipartisan way for as long as Australia has. It's actually a tremendous feat, and it's something to be really proud of. But if you ever hear multiculturalism talked about, it's something to be fought with. Ministers are fighting about amending the Racial Discrimination Act as though that's our biggest priority. When those things go to obfuscate the real achievements Australia has made in promoting a society that is actually really based on egalitarianism, like Marilyn was saying. We do have these core Australian values. They are civic values. They transcend a lot of our past history. They can provide a basis for us to look forward and be a country that brings its people along, regardless of their background, to work toward a better future for our country. And I feel like we don't have the political rhetoric that matches the reality, even of what the government itself is funding. And you have to ask yourself, why? That's silly. Why are you scared to say that you support multiculturalism? So just even if you look at the political term, Labour has always been very, yep, 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 I'm super happy with multiculturalism. They're the ones who started a lot of this mess that we have with asylum seekers. And then you have a Liberal government come in that doesn't really say anything about multiculturalism, but really does still support it. It's moved its agenda slightly. It's taken a more approach that's much more, and look, justifiably so, you can argue, that Australia's multiculturalism is like an economic strength, right? It is a way in which we can leverage investment from China, from India. And look, personally for me, as long as you're going to be funding multicultural initiatives, I'll take it. We can then decide how and when we use this money to try and shape our own agenda and not necessarily tie it to any government agenda of the day. And I think I will start to wrap it up now, but I do think that the big difference between Australia and America is that our narrative, our patriotism, is derived from the past. And you might say, obviously, where else is patriotism supposed to be derived from? But what I'm trying to say is that we can actually start projecting an Australia to the future and give our people, regardless of their race, colour, creed, or political affiliation, we can give each other something to work toward and not necessarily always look to our past to separate us. So thanks very much.